Well, we turn now to a 20-something American who's worried that the lack of leadership today will impact his generation down the road. And when he spoke to recent former leaders, they said that their generation had also missed a moment in history right after the Cold War. Is there a leadership void, or is it impossible to fight against political winds as F.W. de Klerk did in apartheid South Africa? And what does this mean for 20-somethings? Sure, they produced Facebook, but Finland has a far better education system, and that's better leadership. So says Brian Till, an Atlantic correspondent whose book is Conversations with Power. He spoke with a generation of former leaders that includes former presidents Bill Clinton and Prime Minister Paul Keating of Australia. And Brian Till joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
You know, this idea of leadership, you wrote a recent op-ed piece in the Boston Globe about a lecture you heard from a former Yale English professor, William Dershowitz. What did he say about leadership that sort of inspired you?
The whole speech is phenomenal, and it's about the fact we've sort of trained leaders to replicate and not really break new ground and think in really big ways. There's a great actual quote from Nature magazine that I used in the book, and it's about the fact we haven't seen incredible disruptive innovation that changes the world. You know, a personal computer or a cell phone or something like a new MRI that radically reinvents medicine. And it's that even deeper question whether truly vibrant scientific culture is possible without a more widespread societal commitment to free expression. The right to challenge authority, to doubt everything, is central to scientific inquiry. And that's kind of what Dershowitz is saying we don't do very well anymore. So the big question is, you know, and I set out to ask this generation if they failed, if the post-Cold War leaders missed an incredible moment in time. Paul Keating from Australia, in many ways, he and Gorbachev are the two most talented politicians in the book. And I asked him this question about whether the generation failed, you know, and he said, yeah, you know, in the epiphany at the end of the Cold War, when that Berlin Wall came down, there was a rare moment of strategic still. The first one since 1918, and it was an opportunity to recut this world in a cooperative and representative structure. And we let it slip through our fingers. We were kind of so enamored by the internet and by free markets. You know, Greenspan testifying before the Congress not too long ago and saying, we thought the markets would fix themselves. We thought that these banks would not assume all of this risk because it was out of their interest. We've learned now that we need regulation, right? That we need to manage the world in a way we haven't for a while.
And as this former Yale English professor, William Dershowitz, again goes on to say, it's because our overwhelming power and wealth was earned under earlier generations. It made us complacent. For too long, we've been training leaders who only know how to keep the routine going, who think about how to get things done, but not whether they're worth doing in the first place, those kinds of questions. And it's funny because we find ourselves saying, or having other people say all the time in interviews, what Iraq needs is a Nelson Mandela. What the Middle East needs is a Nelson Mandela. And you could add an F.W. de Klerk. You spoke with that former South African leader. Do these people that you speak with, Ehud Barak of Israel, Helmut Schmidt, former chancellor of West Germany, do they all agree that they're not seeing the leadership that they feel is necessary for the times?
Yeah. I mean, Schmidt has a really interesting conversation with Chuck Hagel, who is a great Republican senator from Nebraska at one point. And he says, there's no great leaders on the world stage anymore. And I asked him about that. You know, I said, that's pretty upfront. Why is that? And he said, I think that great challenges breed great leaders. And I said, I mean, look around this world. We look at climate change. It's cataclysmic. We talk about overpopulation. This planet will not sustain 9 billion people. And we will have that by the mid-century. And he said, yeah, but leaders today are thinking about these as massive challenges 30 or 40 years down the line. And they're not. They're here. You know, the Quadrennial Defense Review is a really interesting document. And it says it. It says climate change is being observed in every region on Earth. In the United States, in coastal waters, will increase instability and have massive implications for national security. So we need to get our hands around this. And someone was kind of pushing Clinton this year. The U.S. is the only major world-leading industrialized Western state that has a dominant political movement that doesn't believe in climate change. And someone was kind of leaning on Clinton at Davos, which was a terrific speech this year, and he said, you know, I think it's a little bit like Churchill said, America always does the right thing after she's exhausted every possible alternative. So stick with this idea of, you know, rising to the challenge, and it is the power of one. That comes up again and again. You know, to be an F.W. de Klerk who presided over the dismantling of apartheid and took his, you know, fractional white Afrikaner population that was dominating the state and telling it, you are against the tides right now. You know, we need to change the society. And at one point, he reaches a place where everyone in the political class in his party says, you need to slow down. And what he does, he takes a referendum to the people. And the people said, no, no, we know we're headed towards an iceberg. Make these changes. Open this political system. And that comes up again and again. Gorbachev talks about being in a big Midwestern city, you know, in front of 10,000 people and saying, America needs a perestroika. And there's a standing ovation. You know, he says, we're starting to realize that life on hyper-profits and overconsumption is not tenable. And he also says, in the end, it will be the people. It will be us demanding these changes that actually leads to the kind of stuff we need to have happen rather soon, too.
By the way, how old are you?
I'm 26.
And you've already had a career. I think you worked in politics, haven't you?
I got a little scared of the real world. I should have graduated in 2007. It felt like you had to know what you were doing out there. And we as a generation were always grabbing sort of the next rung. We knew what we had to do to succeed. And then there's this financial collapse, and we just don't have an oar. So I sort of, you know, interned in the Senate and ran around Guatemala. And I started chasing the candidates, you know, Obama and Hillary and Iowa and New Hampshire and Dodd and Gravel and all these places. And it was then that I realized, you cannot get elected president if you speak honestly to these challenges. And Carter says it. You know, when Jimmy Carter and I sit down, he says, yeah, the American people are really bad at hearing hard facts. And we are really bad as a nation at making hard decisions that we all know are right. So, you know, there's sort of this compact. You know, if we cut taxes, you reelect us. And every president since I've been alive has cut taxes. Now we see half the country pays no federal income tax. They pay into Medicare, they pay into Social Security. But that's broken. And we have to set to work fixing it.
So what were you hoping to hear from these former leaders?
I was hoping that they would say, you're not crazy, kid. You know, you are up against the perfect storm. We punted on a lot of hard decisions, and the world is going to be increasingly anarchic. You know, food prices are up through the roof. When we write the history of Egypt and Tunisia, the fact both those regimes had to lift subsidies on food will matter a great deal.
It was actually a food riot that started the very first uprising in Tunisia.
Absolutely. In the last three summers, we've seen 25 food riots in major world cities. You talk to people who work in defense and in intelligence, climate change and resource scarcity, these aren't ifs. These exist, and we need to wrap our hands around them quite quickly.
Brian Till, who set out to study the leadership void, meeting with former presidents and prime ministers who all talked about the demands on their time and said today's leaders must push against the velocity of the digital age, create moments for introspection, cut off the noise fanned by political machines in order to lead. He spoke with people from Jimmy Carter to Pervez Musharraf, the Pakistani military general who led the bloodless coup against Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. But Brian, all of these people speak from a very safe place. Did they offer solutions? Did they say what needed to be done?
It's about us having much more sophisticated conversations about all of this stuff. You know, there's this sort of elegance of simplicity. What is Glenn Beck? He sort of coos in your ear and tells you things that you may think are true, and he doesn't challenge you. He doesn't make you think hard about these things. And we are really bad as a nation at talking about politics. You know, it's kind of an axiom, no politics or religion at the dinner table. And a huge question in here is, did the information revolution, in a very ironic and paradoxical and damning way, make democracy harder? Because it remains as hard as ever before to really understand an issue, but it's really easy to make people think they understand and to scare the heck out of them. And then those voices reverberate and scare the Congress. We have no idea what's going on in Washington. And now it's just this broken system that is two trucks just crashing into each other and seeing who can win.
Which, by the way, might also provoke some sympathy for people trying to lion tame all of the problems that you talked about.
Yeah, you know, there's sort of, Paul Keating says this Australian who's a fantastic leader. He says, you know, there's this view that sort of there's all these donkeys in public life and people who work in the private sector are super sophisticated. And he says that's just not true. But I think what we will see is fewer and fewer talented people going into politics because of what it's become.
Pervez Musharraf, what was your take on him? What did he say to you?
I mean, Musharraf's fascinating because he should have never been president. He should have never even been on top of the Pakistani military. Sharif picks this guy out of obscurity because he hopes he'll be loyal. Of course, he's not very loyal, and there's a coup before too long. He's intriguing because it's a conversation about how we deliver to states that are failing. And he says democracy, civil liberties, newspapers and free press, this stuff isn't as important as the fact that people are becoming more affluent and the state is secure. He says that's the responsibility, and all that other stuff sort of comes along with it. And to me, and I think a lot of us, that's a very false interpretation of democracy, but it's something we see taking hold all over the world, that people are much more interested in gaining wealth than they are in things that we take as sort of granted in this country. And it's going to be interesting as the world becomes more chaotic how many authoritarians we see trying to take hold, and if they are able to deliver in a way they've managed to in Singapore, in a way the Chinese have been able to from Beijing for, you know, half a billion Chinese who have risen up out of poverty in recent years because of their booming economy.
Could you just tick off the name of a leader you spoke to and something that really jumped out at and surprised you? I'm thinking, I know you, for instance, spoke to Ehud Barak, former prime minister of Israel, and he talked about disguising himself as a mechanic with the rest of the Israeli troops who liberated a hijacked plane. I'd forgotten that he was a part of that operation. But he also said he would invest more time in what he called keeping human nature around government, human-to-human interaction. So things like that, little things that surprised you that we haven't heard before from some of these leaders.
One of the things Václav Havel said, who led the Velvet Revolution, is that he's noticed a politician always has a special halo around him and has nothing to do with whether he is an idiot or if he's any good. It's just the position that gives someone a special aura. And he said when he appointed a friend who he'd been in jail with as the foreign minister, he started noticing it because he started respecting him more. Cardoso from Brazil, who kept his nation from having an HIV epidemic like South Africa, where 40% of women have the disease in places, said something that really surprised me. He said, "You have to leave. We take it as a given in this country that a president leaves after 8 years, but in parliamentary systems, in countries that have less respect for laws and institutions, that's not so." And he said, "You start to think you understand things better than everyone else, and it's just not true. In stagnation can be worse for a country than corruption." Paul Keating from Australia, I think, articulated how to lead better than almost anyone in the book. And he said that great leadership is like a streak through the crowd. He said if you move fast enough and with enough confidence, that crowd will always part. But the moment you slow down or are unsure of yourself or stop to look around, you turn into Lot's wife, to a pillar of salt, just like that. Yeah. He said that, nobody was opposed to healthcare reforms in your country, but people will always be opposed to change at the hands of people who don't seem to know what they want to deliver, exactly what they want, and take their nation in a conversation explaining all of that.
Well, Brian Till, you obviously got these interviews, but when you arrived, did anyone say to you, "Who the heck are you to ask me these questions?" Because you push on occasions. Did anyone revert to that, "Don't you know who I am?"
Not really. There's a moment where I show up to meet Gro Brundtland, this prime minister from Norway, and she says, "Who the heck are you?" But it was more curiosity. But overwhelmingly, I could not believe how many of them at the end of interview said, "You know me. You've read some of this stuff." Or Jimmy Carter said, "This is pretty heady stuff you're working with." And what you realize is a lot of people who go in to interview these guys, like Gorbachev. What do you want from Gorbachev? You want him to say one bad thing about Putin and united Russia and democracy rolling back in that country. But they're not interested in full conversations. And that's what this book is. The idea was to cull their minds for their wisdom and not try and soundbite them, but have the kind of sophisticated conversations that we desperately need as a country and really as a world at this point.
That's Brian Till, Atlantic correspondent, research fellow with the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, also author of Conversations with Power, What Great Presidents and Prime Ministers Can Teach Us About Leadership. Brian, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for having me.